Physics World.
Hello, I'm Hamish Johnston, General Physics Editor of Physics World, and you are very welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two of my colleagues who will talk about their recent travels in the world of physics. Mateen Durrani was in London recently, where he visited the Francis Crick Institute, which is the largest single biomedical laboratory in Europe. I will talk to Mateen later in the podcast, but first up is Physics World's industry specialist, Margaret Harris, who has been to two events about quantum technologies. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
So I understand you were at Vienna's Hofburg Palace for the launch of the European quantum flagship. That sounds very swanky. What is the flagship?
So the flagship is a major new initiative by the European Commission, which has put up about 500 million euros. The remaining sort of 500 million is going to come from member countries.
So a total of 1 billion
euros. Total of a billion euros over the next 10 years. And this is the first set of projects, first set of 20 projects were announced formally at this meeting at the very end of October in Vienna to kick off this program. So they're releasing the first 132 million of this eventual 1 billion pounds of funding for applied industrial research, mostly into quantum technologies. There's some money in the flagship for basic research, but it's a lot of it, as it was very clear at the flagship event itself, is aimed at commercializing quantum technologies, taking them out of the laboratory at the demonstration level, the prototype level, and making it possible for companies to then take up and make some of these quantum dreams into reality.
And that sounds like a lot of money. Well, it is a lot of money, a billion euros. But how does that stack up? I mean, what do you get for that? What's the bang for the buck? And how does that compare to, you know, funding around the world?
Well, I think it's an interesting question because the answer is 1 billion euros, a lot of money, is actually something in a quantum superposition of yes and no. Because it's yes because this is not an expensive field of research by physics standards. You know, you don't need to spend a billion euros just building one detector, or, you know, half a billion euros just building one detector like you do in, you know, really big ticket particle physics experiments. Never mind the, you know, several billion dollars it takes to send, you know, a full complete spacecraft on some planetary mission. You know, I worked in a lab that's not too far away from quantum technologies, and you know the most expensive piece of equipment in that lab was probably a laser that cost this is in obviously in sort of mid 2000s pounds, but you know £10,000, something like that, you know, a bit less. So in that respect, a billion euros will go a long way. It'll pay for quite a lot of equipment in the field and quite a lot of people, sort of in terms of PhD students and postdocs and people who are working on projects that wouldn't necessarily otherwise get done. But also, a billion euros is also not a large sum of money because it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get done what you want to get done. And it also doesn't necessarily look all that impressive when you pin it against the fact that the UK alone has now spent, I think, just over half a billion pounds, in this area. And Germany quietly announced that it was going to spend 650 million euros, again, on just its own national quantum technologies program. The U.S. there's some new funding through NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology over there. There's a bill going through Congress with a similar amount of money involved to spend on quantum technologies over a similar sort of time frame. And I think the thing everybody seemed to agree on is that the Chinese are spending lots more money than anybody else on all areas of quantum technologies. They have a real strength in the area and a real early lead. So, and as I said, the other question is, you know, can you actually build the first quantum computer, the first quantum supreme computer, as the idea is that quantum computers that are actually better than classical computers at better, faster, solving certain problems that are technologically important. Can you actually do that for a billion euros? Especially since the billion euros is going to be spread out against lots of different projects. The four areas are quantum communications, quantum computing, quantum metrology and sensing, and quantum simulation, which is sort of early uses for quantum computers, basically, and then basic research being underpinning all of those things. So, you know, yes, it's a lot of money and it'll fund a lot of interesting research and a lot of interesting R&D, but it may not necessarily be enough to meet the challenge, and it's maybe not necessarily stacking up enormously well against initiatives by other countries and other regions.
Now, you mentioned basic research a few times. I understand that there was a bit of a bust up, or maybe that's too strong of a term. Disappointment.
There was some disappointment in the hall. So, I mean, I posted this on Physics World, the website, earlier this week, or last week, I think, actually. But there's a graphic that sort of speaks to the reason for the disquiet. So the flagship got 140 proposals sent in for research projects that people wanted to do. Of those, only 20 got funded, and I think sort of 90 of those projects, 140 were submitted, were in basic research, and only a handful got funded. So I think there were a lot of disappointed people in that sort of glittering ballroom at the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, people who hadn't had their project funded and maybe felt that, in many cases, did feel that basic science was not getting its proper due in the flagship.
So is this a good news story in the sense that that quantum technology has moved beyond basic research, and that people are willing to put a lot of money into actually developing technologies rather than, you know, sort of thinking about science and new technologies?
I think in some areas that's probably the case. I think there's a lot still fundamental research to be done in this area, but there are certain areas, and I think the flagship has nicely captured the ones that meet this criteria, are ready to be sort of pushed out of the lab. And I spoke to Grégoire Ribordy, who's the CEO of ID Quantique, which is one of the first two university spin-outs related to quantum key distribution, which is quantum communications. And he said essentially that physicists need to let their baby go in this area. They need to let the engineers come in and take something from a device that works once in your lab and you're able to get a great paper out of it and turn it into something that works all the time and can be used by someone who treats it as a black box and doesn't even know quantum mechanics, which, you know, as physicists, and Grégoire Ribordy is a physicist himself, so, you know, he understands these things. You know, that sort of cuts to the quick a bit, but, you know, in the same way, you know, if transistors had never left, you know, Shockley's laboratory, we wouldn't be, you know, speaking to you today over the massive internet and that sort of thing. So, you know, these things do happen, and it's part of the necessary wave of things.
And I think when you were at the meeting, you focused a bit on quantum communication, didn't you? You spoke to some people in industry and also in academia about quantum communication. And in particular, I think you spoke to somebody from, is it ID Quantique?
Actually, that's the company. Guy I was just talking to you, to you about, Grégoire Ribordy. And I also spoke to someone who's called Stephanie Vayner, who's the head of a project called the Quantum Internet Alliance, or coordinator for a project called the Quantum Internet Alliance. And they are working with, you know, a number of partners, including in industry, to try to build what's called a quantum repeater, which is something that is it's one of a couple different ways of making quantum key distribution be able to send encrypted signals over very long distances. So at the moment, I think you actually just had a news story just today about quantum key distribution being done over 420 kilometers.
That's
like
right,
that.
Yeah, 421 kilometers.
421 kilometers.
Yeah, ID Quantique were involved in that, along with Corning, which of course is a big maker of optical fibers. And I think that they only busted the record by less than 20 kilometers, but they managed to increase the number of keys, let's say, that can be distributed per second or whatever by a factor of 100. So yeah, it was an important breakthrough.
Yeah, so that's fantastic. But I think, you know, you come from Canada, I come from the U.S. 420 kilometers is nothing over there. It's great for Europe.
Next door neighbor.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so I think that there is definitely a sense that if you want to go beyond sort of metropolitan or small country networks, you're going to need to have something like a quantum repeater, which sort of replicates in a way that doesn't violate the no cloning theorem, which I don't entirely understand yet. But so I'll look into it. But that replicates quantum states and passes them on in a secure way. So that's what a quantum repeater does, and that's what the Quantum Internet Alliance is aiming to build, which is one of the 20 projects that's been funded by the flagship.
And closer to home, I think you were also in London, weren't you? You went to an event about quantum technologies in the UK. So how was that? Well, who did you meet there, and what was the buzz?
Yeah, so this is the UK's own National Quantum Technologies Initiative. There was just an announcement in the UK's budget earlier. I think it was it actually on the 1st of November or the 30th of October? Anyway, sometime around that time frame, announced another £80 million pounds to spend on quantum technologies. This is on top of about £230 million that was announced at the very end of 2013, and another £270 million that was announced earlier this year, which is how I got the figure of roughly £500 million. And it was a showcase of sort of mostly universities partnering with companies, talking about applications of quantum technologies in finance, in healthcare, in civil engineering, aerospace, you know, things like the oil and gas sector is quite interested in quantum sensing, because you can essentially use a quantum system as a sensor for a very sensitive sensor of magnetic fields or gravity to detect subsurface deposits of oil and gas. And then, of course, you need your quantum cryptography to send the information about the oil and gas deposit you found in a very secure fashion, so your competitors don't come in and buy up all that land and the drilling rights and whatever. So there's definitely a sense that a lot of these organizations are looking at different technologies, but they're all sort of converging together. So it was a really the conference was held in the QE2 Center in central London, organized by the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council and Innovate UK, and there was a real buzz in the auditorium there, with a lot of people talking about what they were doing. I have a graph actually that a few years ago there weren't any quantum startups in the UK, and now there's sort of, I think, the 16 by some measures, and wow. The woman who gave me those figures said that she's sure she's missing some. She's sort of put it out there. So this is definitely an area that's been sort of fed by this tranche of government funding has really taken off over the past few years, and it's essentially interesting to watch a new industry being born.
Mm. And would you say it's you're getting the same messages in London that you got in Vienna, and also at other, you know, other times that you've been speaking to people about quantum technologies? Is there a story that's developing in a coherent way?
Well, everything's coherent in quantum technology, of course. It's all based on lasers. But I think, yes, there definitely is a common buzz. And I know I've heard about initiatives in the U.S. as well. So I think, and Canada is a big player in quantum technologies. China, we mentioned before. So I think that there really is a bit of a movement going on, especially towards quantum communications and quantum metrology and sensing. I think quantum computing takes a lot of the headlines because, we've been talking about building quantum computers for years, and suddenly Google's got one that's got 70-something qubits in it, and more every week, it seems like. Someone was telling me that he wishes he had time to look and see what Google's stock price does every time they announce the next level of quantum computer. Is it going up? Is it correlated in any way? So that's a side project for any of our interested listeners to take on, I think. So yeah, I think there's a lot of excitement about this field, and that's definitely coming across in both the events I went to.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Margaret. And I think there are three articles that you've written about your trip to Vienna on the website, and I'm sure there's going to be lots more about the quantum computing industry from Margaret and from others on Physics World. Next up is Mateen Durrani. Hi, Mateen.
Hello, Hamish.
And you have visited the Francis Crick Institute in London's King's Cross district.
That's right. I was up there about 10 days ago. The Francis Crick Institute is in a massive new biomedical sciences research lab, which opened in 2016. There are about 1,500 people there, including a massive 1,250 scientists there. And it's an enormous building, quite spectacular. So people who know London, it's next to St Pancras Station, which is next to King's Cross Station, which is round the corner from the brand new headquarters of the Institute of Physics.
That's right.
And you've got Google nearby, you've got the Nature offices, the Guardian. So it's in this sort of up-and-coming district, which 20 years ago was a bit down at heel, but now is known as the Knowledge Quarter, where a lot of bright, intelligent people are working in science and business and high-tech sectors. So it's a huge building, very impressive. And yeah, I went there a couple of weeks ago to see what the hell's going on there.
So, what was it like? Is it... I'm picturing huge ceilings and atriums and walkways and
well, it is. It looks
light.
You know, it looks an amazing place to work. Huge atrium with labs coming off on six stories left and right. There was a lot of security to get in because it's pretty much central in London, so a lot of sort of busy place to be. And one of the main things is that it's full of relatively people relatively early in their careers. So there are a lot of scientists there, and the idea is that you've got people there for 6 years, and then they can come back again for a second six-year stint. But the idea is you've got a lot of fresh, vibrant people coming in from all sorts of disciplines across the biosciences. So it's very interdisciplinary, full of people enthusiastic at the start of their careers, so you don't get the kind of things sometimes where lots of people have stayed for many years and get stale. A lot of fresh young people, and it's people working across lots of different disciplines, including there are actually some physicists there.
I was going to say, you must have found one or two physicists there.
Well, there was one guy, Martin Jones, unfortunately we didn't get to see. He's going to be writing something for Physics World next year about his work, but we did catch up with a couple of people who aren't exactly physicists, but they're fairly close to they're physical scientists. So the first person we talked to was somebody called Paul Bates. And now Paul originally studied chemistry and crystallography. And what he's involved in is mathematically modelling cells and working with experimental bioscientists about trying to model how cancer cells adapt and change their shape due to physical forces. And we've got a clip coming up now of what Paul had to say to us.
My background is more in structural biology, so I would predict proteins and the conformational states that proteins are accessible to, and design inhibitors for protein-protein interactions. But over recent years, I've moved more into the computational biology of cancer cell movement, how cancer cells are able to find their way from primary tumours into the blood and lymphatic system. Now, to construct these models, I've been working particularly with Dr. Eric Zahai in the Tumor Cell Biology Lab. And what I do with Eric is that we have joint meetings. I look at the data that he has available to construct a mathematical model, use the data to construct the model, and then use other parts of the data to validate the model. And then once we have a model, we're in a very good position. Because what we can do is we can use what we call virtual drugs. So we have a mathematical model of how the cancer cell is moving in two dimensions from the tumor to the blood vessel system. And then we can say, well, if we add a drug to stop contraction at the back of the cancer cell, that will stop the cancer cell moving forward progressively. But also, if we add some other virtual drugs that inhibit adhesion molecules between the cancer cell and the extracellular matrix, that will also slow the cancer cell down. Now, what Eric doesn't know is what proportions to use those drugs in. Now, by having a validated mathematical model of tumor cell motility, we can suggest to him those proportions. So that's exactly what we did, and then he went back to the lab and tested those proportions and indeed found that they were in the right quantity to slow the metastasizing cancer cell down to the maximum extent.
So you also spoke to a colleague of Paul's as well.
Yeah, after we talked to Paul, we went down the corridor and met up with someone called Esther Wershoff, who is a mathematician by training. She did a degree at the University of Warwick, and now has been doing a PhD here at the Francis Crick Institute. And I really enjoyed talking to her. She was very clearly spoken and very enthusiastic about her work. And I talked to her about what it's like being a mathematician working at this fantastic place specializing in biosciences. And here's what Esther had to say about her career.
So my name's Esther, and I'm a fourth-year PhD student here at the Crick, and we have a four-year PhD program that's very well organized. So normally a PhD kind of in a dusty office by yourself for 3 years, but here we have a very constructed program. And I'm actually a mathematician by background. I studied maths at Warwick, and I have a biology GCSE, but that was the last time I did any science. My dad saw an article about the Crick in the Evening Standard, and they were talking about interdisciplinarity, and he rang me and he said, oh, maybe they want someone like you. So somehow I found myself here. And I think the important point about the Crick, I'm sure you've already heard, is this idea of multidisciplinarity, so that it doesn't matter that you don't have a background in science. The idea is that you bring loads of people together who think differently. And hopefully good things happen. So I work very closely with a tumour cell biologist, and we work together on the same problem. So the problem that I'm working on is looking at a type of cell called a fibroblast inside tumours. So fibroblasts make collagen, which normally stops you from getting wrinkly, and it's important when you cut yourself, the fibroblasts go to the site of the wound and they lay down lots of collagen, and that's the basis for your new scar tissue. And in cancer, fibroblasts think that cancer is a wound. So they go to the site of the cancer and they lay down loads of collagen. And that's why when people find lumps, they're hard, because they're actually full of collagen. And what happens is the cancer cells move along the collagen fibers and use the fibers to pull themselves along and spread to other parts of the body. And that's obviously very bad. So what we're looking at is what causes certain patterns of these collagen fibers in tumours that can make a tumour more likely to spread to other parts of the body. So I'm really looking at that from like a physics point of view and a mechanics point of view. And the biologist I work with works at it from an experimental point of view. And we have these kind of two-pronged attack, and we go back and forth between us. And what I find is that I'll suggest something like, well, can we make the cells do this? Or can you do an experiment to do this? And I would say maybe 80% of the time she'll say, no, that's not how cells work, or that's impossible, or, you know, that would take years. But once in a while, she'll say, oh, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. And that's really the point of me being here, is to hopefully give a perspective that wouldn't otherwise have come up.
And the way you were talking, you sounded quite proficient in your biology. How difficult has it been to kind of learn the language of people that aren't mathematicians and pick up their skills and terminology and so on?
So it's really interesting. Coming from a maths department, I find the biologists very socially competent as in comparison to the mathematicians. Also more of a gender mix, which I really like, actually. In terms of the biology, I actually don't... What I think is really great about biology is you can kind of dip in and out. So I would now class my knowledge of tumour cell biology to be pretty high, but I couldn't tell you anything about plants, for instance. So I think you can kind of dip in and out. And that's also sort of the nature of being a scientist. You work on a problem, you get really into it, and then you start on something that you don't know anything about at all. And that's the whole point of being a scientist, is that you're really curious. So actually, yes, I didn't know any biology and it was slightly scary, but the problems are so interesting that you just kind of pick it up as you go. Having said that, there are some biologists who are very guilty of overusing acronyms, and then I have no idea what they're talking
so
about.
So do they feel very sort of scared of working with mathematicians? Do they kind of, because a lot of biologists traditionally, we perhaps unfairly view them as being not very literate mathematically. Do they kind of feel afraid of you, or put off, or worried?
What I think is really nice is, I think this is a really exciting time to, first of all, be at the Crick, where they have all of this hot melting pot of people and ideas. But it is, we're also very much in the middle of a transition to it becoming more and more normal to work with us computational people, the physicists, the computer scientists, the engineers. So I think there are still some people who are a little afraid, but I think actually more and more, particularly sort of with the collaborative nature, even if you're working with a biologist who doesn't feel particularly confident in mathematics, they can team up with another lab head who is maybe more proficient, and it builds up over time. So I think the fear is diminishing, like, as we speak, and there's a lot going on. So I think It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more it happens, the more people get comfortable.
And in terms of the mathematics, do you develop any new mathematical tools, or are you using kind of existing knowledge and applying it to this arena?
It's really hard to classify it, because it ends up being, I'm not really anything anymore. The mathematicians would laugh if I told them I was a mathematician. They'd say, no, you're not. You're a biologist. And the biologist would say, well, no, you're not. You're a mathematician. And I think, so we develop tools, but to do with very specific problems. So, for instance, my work is about, I look at a flocking model. It's called the Vishek model. And I've adapted that to look at the very specific tumor problem that we're looking at. So it is, I'm not developing any sort of pure mathematical ideas, and I kind of miss that. But the whole point is being able to take relevant things and also pick models that you know and find what model works for the problem you're working on, and then you adapt it. So yes and no, sort of depends on how much of a snob people are being.
So the research there, is it mostly fundamental, sort of basic research, or do they have ways of developing, you know, medical processes and cures, etc., out of the, you know, the discoveries that are made there?
Yes, that's right. That's one of what they call the pillars of the work they do. And while we were at the CRIC, we also talked to some people who are involved in translational medical research, how to take those ideas out of the laboratory and into sort of real products. And they work closely with firms like GSK, the pharma industry. And there's also been a couple of spin-off firms set up by people working at the CRIC Institute. So yeah, there is definitely that translation of medical ideas into the real world. That's definitely one of the things they do.
And over the last decade or so, the UK and London in particular has been very, very good at attracting some of the best researchers that or the European Union has to offer. Is there a worry with Brexit looming in just a few months that people won't want to come to work at the Francis Crick, or they'll find it difficult, or perhaps they'll leave instead of staying on for longer? What was the vibe about Brexit there?
Definitely, to me, that seems to be a really big worry. I can't speak for everyone at the Crick Institute, but just by visiting it, there are a huge number of people, a big percentage of people from the EU and from around the world, who are attracted to somewhere like the Crick Institute, which was a huge investment by the British government and by charities in this massive research centre that really wants to be at the world's forefront of biomedical sciences. And as we all know, whenever you've got people who are at the top of their game, they want to move around the world. And if they can't come to London and they find coming to the UK difficult, they may very well go elsewhere. I mean, part of the thing of the Francis Crick, as I mentioned, was that people stay for a maximum of 6 years and then move off to other parts of the ideal is to other parts of the UK. But of course, you can imagine many people will want to go elsewhere in Europe. And there is definitely a sense that people might be reluctant to want to work there in future, or the very cream of the crop may go elsewhere if it's difficult. We don't know how things will pan out. Probably the reality is would be less calamitous than we might think, but certainly the prospect of Brexit doesn't do any favours for a laboratory like the Crick Institute. And, you know, the place is headed by Sir Paul Nurse, Nobel Prize winner, who was the driving force behind this place. And I know he's spoken a lot about the problems that Britain leaving the European Union could be. I mean, we still don't know whether Britain will be part of those EU funding schemes. Let's hope the country remains part of that. But yeah, definitely that was a sort of a worry about the place. But I have no doubt that the Institute will succeed. But it's just something that it could do without, frankly.
Okay, thanks, Mateen. And now we're going to trade places. And Mateen is going to interview me about what's on the website.
Hamish, I love being in your shoes. Can I put on a Canadian accent? So,
you
Hamish.
Can. Well, little known fact, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but Mateen is Canadian. But the accent is a bit lacking.
Well, I was born in Canada, but I don't perhaps sound quite like you. Anyway, Hamish, tell me about what's going on the website this week.
Well, there's a story about tiny robots made out of DNA. We do love a tiny robot story on Physics World. This is a news article called DNA Nanobot Escapes from a Maze. And it describes how a single molecule of DNA, that's the robot, can find its way out of a maze that is also made out of DNA. And the idea is that the robot interacts with the walls of the maze, the DNA-based walls of the maze, and that allows it to follow a path and through the maze. And this is done via a process called proximal strand exchange cascade. The study was done by researchers in Germany and China, and it could lead to autonomous nanoscale robotic systems that could be used in healthcare, for example.
Sounds amazing, Hamish.
Very good.
And you also had an interesting news story about bats and moths.
Yeah, that's right. Bats like to eat moths. And to avoid this from happening, some moths have developed fur that's very good at absorbing audio signals that the bats use for echolocation. This has been discovered by researchers at the University of Bristol. And they say that moth fur could inspire new materials for absorbing sound. You can read about that in Moths Use Acoustic Camouflaging Fur to Evade Bats.
Love that SEO-friendly headline, Hamish. And you also had some, there's also some bad news from the Arctic this week.
That's right. Yeah, this is a climate study. A systematic review of satellite observations, atmospheric analyses, and climate simulations strongly suggests that the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free in the late summer by the year 2040. This is bad news because liquid water is much better at absorbing sunlight than ice, and this means that the melting will lead to further warming. There is a glimmer of hope, however, and this is described in the article, Late Summer Arctic Sea Ice Could Disappear by 2040. And that glimmer of hope is that Arctic sea ice could be stabilized if global warming is kept below 1.5 degrees.
Well, blimey, let's hope we manage to do that. And finally, there's a medical physics story that you wanted to highlight.
Yeah, this actually is a story that's related to cold things. It's called MRI-guided cryoablation safely freezes tumors in the spine. And this article describes a small study where people looked at treating tumors that are compressing the spine and may lead to paralysis. Unlike other treatments, which can have serious risks, cryoablation appears safer as it can be guided using MRI to visualize the ice ball that grows and destroys the tumor. Also, after this cryoablation process, the patient regrows previously eroded bone, and this does not happen during other treatment techniques.
Wow, incredible. So thanks, Hamish, and you're off to the dentist now, so good luck with that.
That's right, yeah, I am off to the dentist, I'm afraid. And that's all for this week's episode of Physics World Weekly. Thanks for listening.
Physics World.